Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Katakshakirana chanta naman mohabdaye namah. Ananta Nanda Krishnaya Jagan Mangala Murtaye. Very good. Excuse me. Okay. Welcome to the webcast of our Tuesday evening class, Vedanta class, on Advaita Makaranda of Lakshmidhara Kavi. We introduced it thoroughly in the first class. In the last class, we discussed the introductory prayer. Just to return very briefly to the introduction, we said that this is an advanced class, and as an advanced class of the main Vedantic sadhana, Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. Shravana, self-inquiry guided by the teachings. Manana, rational reflection to remove doubts and vagueness, and Nididhyasana, Vedantic contemplation. We've said that this advanced text doesn't treat Shravana. It's presumed that you've already done that part of Vedantic sadhana. So our focus is on Manana, rational reflection, and Nididhyasana, Vedantic contemplation. Just an observation here. Notice that if Vedanta was merely a matter of belief, that is to say, you have to believe that your true nature is Satchidananda Atma. You have to believe that inner divinity because of which you exist is the inner divinity because of which everything in the cosmos exists. If that was only a matter of belief, Shraddha, then Shravana would be enough, wouldn't it? Just to hear the teachings of Vedanta and develop your faith and conviction in them. But the fact that Manana and Nididhyasana are such important practices shows that mere faith or belief is not our goal. We start with faith, no doubt. We start with belief. But our goal is immediate personal, direct discovery of your true nature. In Sanskrit, we call that sakshatkara. Sakshatkara means to make it immediate and direct. So the immediate, direct discovery of your true nature, and for the sake of that, we do manana, removing any doubts, which can be obstacles, as we said before, and also nididhyasana, removing other kinds of obstacles. Manana removes obstacles in terms of any doubts or confusion you have with regard to your true nature. And Nididhyasana removes obstacles in the form of habitual wrong thinking, as we've discussed it in some detail before. Now, before we pick up the thread in today's class, there was one question that came up about the complicated Sanskrit terminology we use. You might remember in the last class, we talked about the Satta-traya, the three levels of reality. Paramarthika Satta, absolute reality. Vyavaharika Satta, empirical reality. And Pratibhasika Satta, projected reality. And that came up in the context of the prayer, which is the first verse, where we had asked the question, how can Lakshmidhara, a great teacher of Advaita, and an enlightened teacher of Advaita, how can he begin with a prayer, because prayer so obviously belongs to the domain of duality? And so in response to that, we said that Advaita distinguishes three independent levels of reality, and we have to discern them. Here's a funny thought just came into my mind. Do enlightened people have dreams? Huh. Dreams belong to that pratibhasika satta, absolutely unreal. So if an enlightened person is capable of dreaming and having that lowest level of reality, experience of that lowest level of reality, pratibhasika satta, then why should it be difficult for an enlightened person to participate in vyavaharika satta, empirical life? So enlightened people walk and talk just like anyone else. They participate in the world of duality without taking it as being real. Just as you don't take your dreams as being real, an enlightened person doesn't take this worldly experience as being real. And in this world of duality, we most certainly have a relationship with Ishvara, the creator, sustainer, destroyer of this world. So our relationship with Ishvara belongs to the empirical level of reality, meaning, as I concluded in a prior class, Ishvara is as real as you and me, yet there's a further reality. The reality because of which you and me and the world and Ishvara, the reality because of which all these exist, Ishvara, the world, and us, everything exists because of non-dual Brahman, the ultimate reality, Paramarthika Satta. Anyway, so that summarizes much of our last class. The question came about, is it necessary to use all these complicated terms in Advaita Vedanta? And I admitted in a prior class that Paramarthika Satta it's a mouthful. It's a long, complicated, and difficult to pronounce term. Vyavaharika Satta, Pratibhasika Satta. These are complicated terms. Why do we bother with them? Why don't we just stay with English? And let me share with you a very important observation, something I learned from my guru, Pujya Swami Dayananda. He was very particular about using particular Sanskrit terminology, Sanskrit terms, because the English equivalents weren't very clear. For example, suppose I were to use the word soul. What does soul mean? And then you will have one definition of soul. Another person will have yet another definition. So the word soul can mean different things to different people. So therefore, we don't use that term at all when teaching Advaita Vedanta for the sake of clarity. Similarly, words like, I don't know what other examples. But the point is that by using technical terms, the medium is English, the technical terms are Sanskrit. And the reason for staying with these Sanskrit terms is it brings a tremendous degree of precision and clarity to these teachings. Many people have remarked that when they listen to me, they hear things more clearly than they hear otherwise. And it's not me, it's the use of these very clear terms. So we will continue to use them throughout. You know, by analogy, many of you work in some kind of profession where you use a lot of technical terms. If you're in science or technology or even in business, you have a lot of complex terms that you use in your work every day. Imagine without those terms, the terminology and the acronyms that you use every day in your work, if you couldn't use any of them, you'd find it very difficult to work. So it's just practical to use a set of important terms. And here our terms happen to be in Sanskrit, and that does lead to some pronunciation problems, that you can handle that. And I will continue to put important terms on the board so that you can see them. Okay. With that introduction, we are ready to proceed to the second verse. You can repeat after me, please. Ahamasmi sadabhami, ahamasmi sadabhami, kadachinahamapriyaha, kadachinahamapriyaha, brahmaivahamatah siddham, brahmaivahamatah siddham, satchidanandalakshanam, satchidanandalakshanam. So the opening verse was a prayer. The teachings of this text really begin with this second verse. And in the second verse, what is the very first word? Aham. Aham, as many of you know, is the Sanskrit pronoun I. I happens to be, I is our English pronoun. Aham is a Sanskrit pronoun. You might remember from our discussion in the Atma Bodha class where I said when verses are written in the first person, mostly Vedantic texts are written in the third person. Atma is Satchidananda, is an expression in the third person. Occasionally, Vedantic teachings come in the second person, like Tat Tvam Asi. Asi, you are. Tvam Asi, you are Tat. You are that. But most of Vedantic teachings are in the third person. Here, the entire text, except for the first verse and the last verse is a concluding verse, all the teaching verses in the middle of the text, they're all in the first person. And as we discussed in our Atma Bodha classes, when verses are in the first person, that often means they're for the sake of nididhyasana contemplation. The author puts the verses in first person so that you can more directly use them in your Vedanta contemplation. Nididhyasana. Ahamasmi sada bhami. Ahamasmi, I am sada. I am, I always exist. Aham sada bhami. I always shine with the light of consciousness. So putting that in the first person makes it very suitable for meditation, for contemplation. And we'll come back to exactly how that contemplation is to be done at the end of our class. We'll come back to that point. Another reason for beginning with the pronoun I is I is the locus of the problem and the locus of the solution. My guru used these exact words. The locus of the problem. First of all, what problem? The problem of suffering. Vedanta, the teachings of Vedanta, are a solution to the problem of suffering. And the locus of the problem of suffering is I. Suffering belongs to I, whoever says I. And the solution then, the locus for the solution is that same I. And if you wonder, well, wait a minute, how can the same I be the problem and the solution? Here we have to recall what a pronoun means. You remember from your grammar classes how long ago that pronoun means to stand for a noun. So a pronoun can stand for so many things. And a pronoun I can stand for any number of things. For example, the pronoun I can represent Swami Tadatmananda, a teacher of Vedanta. The same pronoun I can refer to this physical object sitting in the chair. For example, if I say, I am male, in that expression, I am male, the term I doesn't refer to a teacher of Vedanta. The term I refers to this physical body because the gender of this physical body happens to be male. So to say, I am Swami Dayan, Swami Tadatmananda, talking about my guru. When I say, I am Tadatmananda, that term I refers to a role, correct? It does, a role. Swami Tadatmananda is a role. When I say I am male, when I say I am getting old, when I say I'm just that much, in those expressions, the term I refers to a physical body, different. I am Tadatmananda, I refers to a role. I am male, I refers to the physical body. Suppose I say I am sick or I am tired. In those cases, I refers not exactly to the body, but to the life force inside the body, prana. Do you remember studying the five koshas? Annamaya kosha, pranamaya kosha, and then manomaya kosha. If I say I am happy or sad or I am agitated, I'm referring to the term I refers to my mind. And if I say I am intelligent or I am dull, the term I refers to my buddhi, intellect, vijnanamaya kosha. Notice how this term I is very flexible. I can mean role. I can mean physical body. I can mean prana, life force. I can mean mind. When I say I am happy or sad, the term I is pointing to my mind. If I say I am bright or dull, the term I refers to intellect. That's how pronouns work. And that's why pronouns are the cause of the problem. You know, the pronoun I said, as I said before, is the locus of the problem. When I is connected to role, body, prana, mind, senses, anything other than your true self, which we'll come to in just a moment. When I is connected to anything other than your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, you end up suffering. Why? Here's why. If I am the role, Swami Tadatmananda, then all of Swami Tadatmananda's problems become my problems. You say, what? Swami Tadatmananda has problems? And so to speak, I have a lot of emails to answer every day. We'll call that a problem. I have to do some administration of our ashram. So these are not big problems, but they're problems. So if I say I am, if I equals Swami Tadatmananda, then the problems of that role, the headache of answering emails and doing all the ashram administration, I end up owning those problems due to identification. So that pronoun I shows the problem of identification. If I'm identified with the role of Swami Tadatmananda, I own the problems of Swami Tadatmananda. If I'm identified with the body, which is getting old and having more problems, then I inherit the problems of my body. If I'm identified with prana, life force, then if I'm tired and I identify myself with that tiredness, then I go on complaining. Oh, I'm so tired. I'm so tired. When you say, I'm so tired, you suffer. And that suffering is a result of identification. Look at this. In the absence of identification, suppose I say, thank goodness, all those emails are not my problem. They belong to the role, Swami Tadatmananda. Then I don't suffer. And honestly, I don't feel like they're a problem at all. Don't be afraid of emailing me. I'm telling you, it's not truly a problem. It could be if I were identified with the role. Similarly, the problems of my body, thank goodness, they belong to my body and not to me. My body is getting old, but the true I is not getting old. mind can be happy or sad, agitated or not. But those problems also, thank goodness, they belong to the mind. They don't belong to me. Any problems of the intellect belong to the intellect. They don't belong to me. You can disidentify with the role, with the body, with the mind, etc. You can disidentify if you properly connect the word I to your true self. And who is that true self? Well, that's what this verse is all about. So what is the ultimate meaning of the word I? So if I is a pronoun, it refers to many, many things. Suppose we were to pose this question. What is the most fundamental meaning of the pronoun I? Or to put it in other terms, an expression you've heard so many times, who am I? This is the prototypical Vedantic inquiry. Who am I in essence? In the most fundamental way possible, who am I? And that brings us to our verse. So who am I in the most fundamental, essential way, without all this identification with role, body, mind, and senses, etc.? And he begins in the best, in the most clear and direct possible way. Aham asmi. I am. No one can deny that statement. You can notice the other kinds of I can change. So before I was Swami Tadatmananda, I was a computer engineer in California in the 1970s. So notice the role can change. The body can change. It changes from being young to being old. Your life force changes from being healthy to being ill, or from being ill to being healthy. Your mind continually changes. Your intellect continually changes. All of these, can we call them auxiliary eyes? I don't know if that makes any sense to you. Secondary eyes. I meaning the pronoun, not these eyes on my forehead, but the I as a pronoun. All of these are secondary eyes, auxiliary eyes, not the fundamental I. All of those other eyes change. What doesn't change? Aham asmi. I am. Never, ever changes. And what kind of I am I? And here we come to the most fundamental teachings of Vedanta. Who are you in the most fundamental sense? You are the conscious being. I'm choosing these words very carefully. You are the conscious being by whom all experiences are known. I'll say that again. This is a very clear and important definition. That fundamental I is a conscious being by which all experiences are known. Whatever is happening right now is known to you. And as we discussed at some length in Atma Bodha, all things are known to you because they take place in your mind. They're projected into your mind. Everything your five senses pick up is projected into your mind. All of your thoughts are in your mind, your perceptions, your emotions. All of that takes place in your mind. And whatever takes place in your mind is known to you. So in a most fundamental sense, you are the conscious being who knows whatever is taking place in your mind. This is where we begin. You are a conscious being who knows whatever is taking place in your mind. Now we have to explore the terms conscious and being. When we say you are conscious, that means, by the way, we use the word consciousness and awareful as synonyms. We don't make any difference. You are an awareful being. You are a conscious being, a sentient being, a knowing being. You get the point. So whatever happens in your mind is known to you, the conscious being. What kind of conscious being? He has that adjective here, sada, always. Aham asmi, I am. Aham sada bhami, I sada, always bhami, shine. And this is a metaphor we use in Vedanta. When we say that I shine, somebody made a bad joke about people having auras, and their auras shine. Well, that's got nothing to do with Vedanta. Auras have absolutely nothing to do with Vedanta. This shining refers to a Vedantic explanation of how it is that you know what's happening in your mind. Whatever is happening in your mind is an object, not a physical object, but we'll call them non-physical objects. Non-physical objects like thoughts, non-physical objects like emotions, non-physical objects like your sensations, whatever you see, hear, taste, smell, and touch. All these non-physical, sukshma, all these non-physical objects occur in your mind, and in order for them to be known, in Vedanta we say that they are illumined, as it were. This is a metaphor. The activities of your mind, vrittis, we call them, thoughts, emotions, sensations, these vrittis are illumined by your consciousness. Your consciousness is like a light. The metaphor is your mind is like a room full of objects, objects being thoughts, emotions, sensations, and those various mental objects are illumined, just like light illumines objects in a room, in the same way the light of consciousness illumines vrittis, mental objects in your mind. So since we use that metaphor so regularly, he says, aham sada bhami, I always shine. I always illumine the activities in my mind. And always means always. Sorry. What it means is every moment of the day when you're awake, whatever is happening in your mind is illumined by the light of your consciousness and therefore known to you. Notice I said whatever is happening in your mind, we exclude the unconscious. Psychology has an elaborate teaching about that which is unconscious. By definition, that which is unconscious is not available for consciousness. So we're talking about activities in your mind. Everything that happens in your mind throughout the long day, every moment of those activities illumined by consciousness. Then at night you go to bed, you sleep, and you dream. So while you're dreaming, everything that happens in your dream is similarly illumined by consciousness. There's not so much difference between the waking state, jagrat avastha, for those of you who... In fact, we use these terminology in our Atma Bodha class. As I said before, I'm presuming you've watched those Atma Bodha class lectures. And if you haven't, it's a really, really good way to be prepared for this more advanced class that we're studying right now. So in Jagrat Avastha, the waking state, you are the awareful illuminer, the conscious being who reveals all the activities in your mind while you're awake. Aham sada bhami, I, aham bhami, I shine. Then in the dream state, swapna avastha, you continue to shine as consciousness and illumine all the activities of your mind while you're dreaming. What about deep sleep? Does consciousness cease to shine in deep sleep? Now, in terms of experience, is actually in experience, mere experience is not enough to draw a conclusion here. Because there's two possibilities based on your experience of deep sleep. What do you experience in deep sleep? Nothing. Kuch nahi, you'll say. Nothing you experience in deep sleep. But based on that experience of nothing, there are two possibilities. One is that consciousness ceases to shine in deep sleep, one logical possibility. There's a second logical possibility, and that is consciousness continues to shine, but there's nothing to be seen. You see the two possibilities. One possibility of deep sleep, consciousness ceases to shine. The other possibility is consciousness continues to shine, sada, always, continues to shine, but there's nothing to be seen. Your mind has become totally and absolutely silent. That would equally explain the experience of deep sleep. There are any number of arguments that we use in Vedanta to establish the fact that consciousness doesn't blink on and off in deep sleep. I made a joke once about the light bulb in your refrigerator. When the refrigerator door is open, the light is on. When you close the refrigerator door, the light goes off. First of all, how do you know it's off? You're not really sure it's off. You presume it's off, but even so, why should a refrigerator light bulb represent consciousness? Consciousness is extraordinary. It's the truth of who you are, not something ordinary like a light bulb in a refrigerator. Consider this. Consciousness shines, illumining every millisecond of activity in your mind all day long. It illumines every millisecond of activity in your mind when you're dreaming. So if it has already illumined thousands and millions of milliseconds of activities throughout the day and dream, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that it continues to shine, to illumine during deep sleep, but in the absence of any mental activities to be illumined? If there's nothing to see, it looks like there's nothing there. The metaphor, most of you have heard me use this explanation many, many times. And that is, if you stand in a perfectly dark place, imagine a closet in your home. You go and stand in that closet, close the door behind you, and imagine it being absolutely perfectly black, so black that you can't see the hand in front of your face. While you stand in that perfect darkness, can you see? Do you still possess the power of sight? You do. The fact is that due to darkness, there's nothing that can be seen. You see, but there's nothing to be seen. Look at this is just for fun. If somebody wants to insist that your consciousness suddenly turns off in deep sleep, I would say that would be like explaining your experience in a dark closet like this. Before you enter the closet, you have the power of sight. Then as soon as you enter that dark closet, your power of sight goes away. And as soon as you come out of the closet, magically your power of sight returns. Is that reasonable? That explains how unreasonable it is to assert that your consciousness ceases to exist in deep sleep. It continually shines. Sada bhami. Aham sada bhami. I always shine as consciousness. The word we often use for consciousness is chit or chaitanya. Chit, as in Sat Chit Ananda. And this, in fact, this verse is explaining the three words, Sat Chit Ananda. We'll see that in just a moment. So, in the expression, Sat Chit Ananda, Atma, Chit means that consciousness which continually shines in the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state without interruption, constantly shining consciousness, your true nature. And that consciousness is also the expression, aham asmi sada, sada, aham, I, sada, always, asmi, I always am, I always exist. The word exist is in Sanskrit is sat. Sat is existence in Sanskrit. Here we go, sat chit ananda. So when our author says, aham asmi sada, I always exist, he's talking about not only does your consciousness persist, your existence persists. Persists in what way? Before birth? After death? Notice before your body was born, you... We explore this in great depth in Atma Bodha. We'll do it very briefly here. You exist as a conscious being. Conscious, chit, being, sat. That's what these words mean. Conscious being, chit, sat. You exist as a conscious being. Notice that that consciousness we just determined doesn't blink on and off in deep sleep. Well, if it doesn't blink on and off in deep sleep, well, why should it blink off at death? Same thing, right? If consciousness doesn't blink on and off in deep sleep, then what is the basis for saying it blinks off at death? Consciousness continues to shine after the death of your physical body. Of course, there's nothing for that consciousness to illumine, so we can very easily postulate the experience of being dead. If you ask, what is it like to be dead? It's exactly the same as being in deep sleep. You experience absolutely nothing, but that consciousness continues to shine, unchanged, after the death of your body, and that means before the death of your body, assuming there is such a thing as reincarnation, before the birth of your body, aham asmi sada, I always exist. After the death of your body, aham asmi sada, I always exist. That sat then gets a special kind of meaning. Not just existence, but real existence. We have a very important technical definition for real. Real is, and for our Sanskrit students, trikala abaditam, non-negatable in the three periods of time, past, present, and future. To put it in more simple terms, real is that which exists unconditionally. It exists now. It exists in before now, without beginning. It is beginningless. It exists now, and it exists after this moment for all time. It is endless. That which is beginningless exists now and is endless, is real. Non-negatable in the past, present, and future, trikala abaditam, that is real. So the term sat in sat chit ananda doesn't merely mean existent, it means real. So in the expression sat chit ananda, we're describing your true nature as consciousness, consciousness that doesn't blink on and off ever, always shining, and that always shining consciousness exists always, past, present, and future, absolutely real. Okay, that's the first one. What are we doing on time? Okay. And so we have sat and chit in the first line. You won't be surprised if the next line talks about ananda. Correct. Kadachit na aham apriyaha. A little tricky because it uses a double negative. It's, you see the word aham buried in there. Aham, I, na kadachit. We have to break these words apart and put them in proper order. Aham, I, na kadachit, never. I am never apriyaha. Priya means desirable. Apriyaha, undesirable. I am never undesirable. What a it sounds like a very peculiar way of expressing ananda, but it's actually a very accurate way of expressing ananda. Why is it more accurate to say, I am never undesirable? Why don't we say, I am bliss? Because everyone translates ananda as bliss. Well, you may have heard me discuss this topic before. I do many times, and that is, bliss is an awful translation for ananda in this context. Ananda has many meanings. One of those many meanings, indeed, is bliss. But in this context, talking about your true nature, ananda cannot mean bliss, because bliss is something you experience, is it not? Bliss takes place in your mind. Bliss is a vritti that appears in your mind and is revealed by you, by the conscious being. You are the revealer, and bliss is revealed, a vritti in your mind, which means bliss is a mental object. It's not you. Anyway, well, I'm pointing out the defect of translating ananda as bliss. Notice he doesn't try to do that. He says, I am never undesirable. So let's examine why he uses that particular expression. In my notes, I made a reference to Pujya Swami Dayananda, my guru, loved a particular expression in this context. He said, we all seek a pleased self, relating to that word priya. A priya atma, a pleased self. We all seek a pleased self. And what that refers to is the condition of being pleased, a condition of being content, a condition of perfect peace, a condition of perfect satisfaction. Notice I'm not using the word bliss, which is an experience. The words I'm using are referring not to something you experience, they're referring to the nature of Atma as ananda, ananda properly understood. So pleased self, the term my guru used, was in this sense. You want always to remain content, satisfied, free from suffering. Interesting. There's a metaphor that is sometimes used to describe this state. Consider this. If perfect peace and contentment was not innate, was not your true nature, then it would be okay. You'd be comfortable with it. So let me formulate a question. Can you be comfortable in a presence of suffering and misery? By definition, no one is comfortable in a presence of suffering and misery. We want to be free from suffering and misery. We want to have that state of being pleased. the metaphor that's used to describe this is when you get a tiny speck of dust in your eye, even though it's a very tiny speck, it's enough to irritate your eye quite a bit. It irritates because it doesn't belong there. It is unnatural to your eye. And that metaphor leads us to this conclusion. Any kind of suffering and misery is unnatural to you. It's not your true nature. Your true nature is not misery and suffering. Otherwise, you'd be comfortable in the presence of misery and suffering, but it doesn't belong there. Like the speck of dust doesn't belong in your eye. Misery and suffering are unnatural to you. What is natural to you is contentment, peace. Notice I'm not using the word bliss. So this contentment and peace is natural to you. That's why he uses this term, kinchit na aham apriyaha, na kinchit, never, aham, am I, apriyaha, undesirable to myself. We always want that pleased self that remains in the absence of any kind of suffering and misery. Someone might object here. What about someone who commits suicide? That would be a good argument here. So someone who commits suicide is, they don't love themselves. Here it says, here the author says, I am never undesirable. Well, someone who commits suicide obviously has concluded that their life is undesirable. But if you examine that a little bit more closely, and you know this already, someone who commits suicide is overwhelmed by pain and suffering. And it's easy to understand how they're driven not to end their existence, they're driven to end the pain and suffering. If that suicidal person were free of pain and suffering, they would no longer consider suicide. So the point here is everything that's done is done for the sake of that pleased self, for the sake of contentment, satisfaction, or negatively speaking, for the absence of suffering and misery. Everything is done for the sake of pleased self, even suicide. Now, this leads to another Vedantic teaching about the nature of Atma. When we say Atma is Ananda, in the expression Sat Chit Ananda Atma, Atma is Sat Chit, as we discussed in the first line. Here, Atma is Ananda, not bliss, but here's another explanation. Atma is the source of joy and happiness. When you experience joy, happiness, bliss, we'll call it that. When you experience bliss, suppose you have your favorite kind of ice cream, assuming you like ice cream. It's your favorite flavor, chocolate, whatever it is, and you eat that chocolate ice cream and it is bliss. Commonly we use that kind of expression. The bliss of the chocolate ice cream, where does that bliss come from? You know very well that bliss is not an ingredient in the ice cream. Yet, when you eat that chocolate ice cream, you experience bliss. The logic is so simple. You experience bliss. That bliss can't come from the ice cream. Where else can it come from? It comes from your true nature. So another way of understanding Ananda is the source of the experience of bliss. Notice I didn't say Atma is bliss. Ananda is bliss. Atma is Ananda, but that Ananda is not bliss. That Ananda is the source of the experience of bliss. all happiness and joy emerges in your mind due to the fact that your nature as consciousness is Ananda, source of Ananda, source of bliss, source of happiness, source of joy. The metaphor that's often given in Vedanta, you won't, this ice cream metaphor is really nice. The metaphor that's often given by commentators is not so nice. The metaphor that the commentators give is, imagine a dog chewing on a dry bone. The dog chews and chews and chews and gets something, gets some rasa, gets some juice out of that dry bone. And that makes the dog chew even more violently, vigorously. The dog is chewing that dry bone to get more and more juice out of the bone. Of course, the juice isn't coming from the bone at all. The juice is actually blood coming from the dog's gums as that dog is chewing that dry bone. Not a very pretty metaphor, but it makes the point. The point being that the source of juice that the dog enjoyed was not the object, the bone. The source was itself, its own blood. In the same way, whenever you have a joyful experience, a blissful experience, the source of that joy or bliss is not the object, it is you, your true nature. And that's why the word Ananda is included. So you are Sat Chit Ananda. Atma is Sat Chit Ananda. Chit, consciousness, which is Sat, no beginning, no end, eternal, and Ananda, source of happiness and bliss. Okay, those are the first two lines. Then the third line, Satchitananda, is what I've just said, Satchitananda Lakshanam. That aham, I, is one whose lakshana, one whose description, one whose nature is Satchitananda. So this is what most of the verses is establishing here, is to establish your true nature as Atma. What is Atma? Sat Chit Ananda, defined as we just did. You do realize that sometimes people casually refer to Atma as soul. What massive confusion if you were to replace the word Atma with soul or spirit. I'm going back to the comment about the use of technical terminology in our Vedanta classes. So the use of soul or spirit, even self, isn't very clear. Soul, spirit, self are unclear. Atma, which is Sat Chit Ananda, is perfectly clear. That's why we use these technical terms. Now, the verse concludes, really, with the third line. And the third line says, Ataha, therefore, from this discussion, from the fact that Atma is Satchitananda, Ataha, because of the fact that Atma is Satchitananda, from this fact, Siddham, it is established, it is proved. What is proved? Brahma eva aham. We have to break the words apart. Brahma eva aham. Aham, I, our pronoun again. Brahma eva, I am Brahman eva, alone. I am Brahman and nothing but Brahman. Based on what? It says siddham. It is established, it is proved. Proved by establishing that I am Satchitananda, it is simultaneously established that I am Brahman. How? Let me go to the board and show you. So we just established in the first two lines of the verse that sat chit ananda is Atma. Yes. So Atma is sat chit ananda. Now, in another scripture, in particular the Taittiriya Upanishad, comes a famous definition. That word lakshana in the final line. Lakshana means definition. So Satchitananda lakshana means the definition of Atma is Satchitananda. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, there's another lakshana, a definition, not for Atma, but for Brahman. And what is that definition for Brahman? Many of you know. Satyam jnanam anantam. In the Upanishad, Satyam jnanam anantam brahma. It's chanted in that manner. So this is a definition of Brahman. Brahman we define as the sarva karanam, or the cause of all causes, the absolute reality because of which everything exists. So what is it that allows anything at all to exist? For something to exist, it must have existence. Brahman is called Satyam, reality, pure existence. Brahman gives reality to the universe like clay gives reality to a pot, gives existence to a pot. I'll say that again. Brahman gives, let me use better terminology. Brahman gives, let me turn it around also. Like clay gives existence to a pot, Brahman gives existence to the universe. Clear? Like clay gives existence to a pot, Brahman gives existence to the universe. And the word satyam, meaning real, refers to Brahman as the source of pure existence. Like clay is the satyam for a pot, Brahman is the satyam, the underlying reality for the entire universe. Now, the entire universe is not like a bunch of clay pots. Clay pots are inert, jada, insentient. The universe is full of intelligence, full of sentiency, and not just you and me, but every living thing on our planet is endowed with some kind of intelligence, some kind of sentiency. And beyond the planet, who knows? I mean, there's so many other planets out there in the galaxies that it's entirely possible there's intelligent life on other planets. The point here is our universe is not like a bunch of pots. Our universe is endowed with intelligence. And the source of that intelligence is indicated here by the word jnanam. Commonly, jnanam means knowledge. In this context, jnanam referring to Brahman, knowledge refers to Brahman as being the source of intelligence in the universe. So to say Brahman is satyam jnanam anantam is to say Brahman is satyam, the source of existence for everything in the universe. Brahman is jnanam, the source of sentiency, intelligence, consciousness for everything in the universe. And that Brahman is anantam, limitless, boundaryless, vast, all-pervasive. Now, we have two lakshanas. A lakshana, a definition of Atma as Satchitananda, and a definition of Brahman as Satyam Jnanam Anantam. And Lakshmidhara concludes here, Siddham it is established. What is established? Brahma eva aham. Aham, I am Brahman eva. How is that established? By seeing the connection between these three words. We're at the end of the class. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, so let me... In fact, the rest of the text is about this, so let me deal with this in general now, and then we'll deal with it in more detail in the coming verses. When you see the equivalence of sat and satyam, the equivalence of chit and jnanam, and the equivalence between ananda and anantam, if you can see the equivalence, then you see the identity of Atma and Brahman. In the expression Brahma eva aham, aham refers to Atma. I am Brahman. Okay, let's come back. Very good. So, we can't get into, at the very end of this class, we can't get into all the details of this correspondence, but here's a general observation. Satchidananda Atma is that because of which you exist. It is you. It is the essence of your existence. If you consider yourself as a living being, like the person you see sitting before you, that this living being has an essence, a fundamental nature, fundamental reality. And the fundamental reality because of which this living being exists, its essence is Sat Chit Ananda, Atma. If we consider that the universe exists because of Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, then it's not a stretch to make this observation. The reality because of which I exist and the reality because of which everything else exists must necessarily be the same reality. Let me say that again. The fundamental reality because of which I exist as a conscious being, and the fundamental reality because of which the universe exists with all of its intelligence, how could those be two separate, independent realities? They must necessarily be one and the same reality. That oneness and sameness is what we're going to see developed in the coming verses. And just one last comment before we conclude here. And that is, we said that this text is meant for manana and nididhyasana. Manana we've just done. 1 hour of manana is the essence of this class. Nididhyasana is like your homework assignment. And how does that nididhyasana work? If you don't know what nididhyasana is, it's crucial. You have to go back to our Atmabodha lectures and listen to that section on nididhyasana and get that very clearly. I'm not going to explain it in great detail here, but here's how nididhyasana would work. To make your mind perfectly silent using whatever meditation techniques you've mastered, and then having created that perfect silence in your mind, in that silence, all that remains is your essential nature. Body is gone, mind is gone, everything else is gone. All that remains is Satchidananda Atma. So the way nididhyasana would work here is you make your mind perfectly quiet so that all that exists, all that remains is Satchidananda Atma. And then you can contemplate on this question. How could the reality because of which you exist possibly be different than the reality because of which the universe exists? It's an example of nididhyasana. each one of these verses can be used for Nididhyasana. It's a very advanced practice, and we'll talk more about Nididhyasana in future classes. We'll conclude with a prayer. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhagvaveta, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Tat Sat.